From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Today, both President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair were again forced to defend the case they made for war against Iraq. Over the past week, one disputed sentence in the State of the Union address about African uranium has prompted closed-door hearings and criticism on Capitol Hill. The president's critics say the uranium story is typical of a broader problem, a tendentious, alarmist case for a preventive war, a case that is not weathering the test of time and subsequent disclosures.
Mr. Bush's supporters say those were just 16 ill-chosen words, one statement mistakenly left in a speech, one fragment of an otherwise solid case. In this segment of the program, we're going to revisit three other claims that were made in support of going to war. Claims about aluminum tubes and their possible nuclear use, claims about chemical weapons, and about links between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. They were all elements in the argument summed up by Secretary of State Colin Powell at the UN in February.
We know that Saddam Hussein is determined to keep his weapons of mass destruction. He's determined to make more. Given Saddam Hussein's history of aggression, given what we know of his grandiose plans, given what we know of his terrorist associations, and given his determination to exact revenge on those who oppose him, should we take the risk that he will not someday use these weapons at a time, in a place, and in a manner of his choosing, at a time when the world is in a much weaker position to respond?
One piece of evidence that was cited as proof of Saddam Hussein's pursuit of more weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, was Iraq's pursuit of some aluminum tubes. This is what President Bush said in the State of the Union address.
Our intelligence sources tell us that he has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes suitable for nuclear weapons production. Saddam Hussein has not credibly explained these activities. He clearly has much to hide.
Reporter Walter Pincus covers national security for The Washington Post and has researched the story of the aluminum tubes. Walter Pincus, do we know, in fact, that the aluminum tubes in question were suitable for nuclear weapons production?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but suitable is an odd word to choose. The Iraqis from day one said the tubes were for a rocket artillery piece. And in fact, the length is correct for that purpose, the thickness is correct for that purpose, and they are anodized. They have a chemical covering on them, which makes them perfect for the artillery piece. What the U.S. intelligence services, in this case particularly the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, are saying is that if you cut the tubes down, if you ream them out, in other words, made them thinner on the outside, and if you then removed the chemical covering, you could then use it for a centrifuge, which is a key part in taking uranium oxide and turning it into weapons-grade uranium.
Now, is it plausible that Iraq would go to great lengths and acquire things that would be for one purpose, ostensibly artillery pieces, knowing that it would be difficult to get the right size and the right kind of aluminum tube?
Well, the irony of the whole intelligence around this issue is that when we first learned they were shopping around to buy them, they, in their own right, had to be declared under the sanctions that Iraq agreed to at the end of the 91 war, and they didn't do it. They were covertly trying to buy them for even the artillery use. And then in July of 2002, we actually intercepted a shipment that they had purchased, and we examined them. And it was following that examination that you began to get this internal fight within the U.S. intelligence community looking at the tubes and becoming more questioning as to whether they, in fact, were to be used for nuclear centrifuges.
Once the U.S. added such modifiers as tubes suitable for, or that could be modified for the purpose of enriching uranium, was the United States earlier this year making a justified, valid claim, or was it stretching a point?
Well, in fact, in the still classified national intelligence estimate, which is the consensus of the community, this particular item has attached to it a caveat. Most analysts believe it could be used for a centrifuge.
Most, you're saying, but not all.
Most, but not all, and as pointed out to me by one of the critics of the president, in his speech, he carries no caveat at all.
Walter Pincus of The Washington Post, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
To another of the claims the Bush administration made to justify a preemptive war, Iraq's alleged chemical weapons program. Here again is Secretary Powell at the UN in February.
Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. That is enough agent to fill 16,000 battlefield rockets. Even the low end of 100 tons of agent would enable Saddam Hussein to cause mass casualties across more than 100 square miles of territory, an area nearly five times the size of Manhattan.
And for more on chemical weapons, we're joined now by Elisa Harris, who worked on chemical, biological, and missile proliferation issues at the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
These estimates cited by Secretary of State Powell, where did they come from?
Well, the Powell estimate comes from a report done by the CIA in October of 2002, but the secretary didn't quite characterize the judgment accurately. The CIA said Iraq probably has 100 to 500 metric tons of chemical agents. He didn't say that Iraq had 100 to 500 metric tons, and in fact, there was a significant divergence of opinion within the intelligence community over whether Iraq even had chemical weapons or was producing them.
It was certainly perceived to be enough of a threat that all forces were outfitted with chem-bio suits, and the fear was that an attack would be launched as the troops got closer and closer to Baghdad. That didn't happen.
It didn't happen. No one knows exactly why that's the case. It's either because they didn't have the weapons, and there is a fairly good reason for suspecting that that's the answer, given that nothing has been found by U.S. or British troops and teams that have been operating in Iraq for the past few months. It's also plausible, of course, that whatever capability they may have had may have been spirited out of the country. Secretary Rumsfeld has emphasized this possibility, but there's no actual evidence, again, to support that. At the moment, it's just a hypothesis.
The question posed by the administration has been, if Saddam Hussein had nothing to hide, then why didn't he come clean? If these stocks were destroyed, where was the proof? There was none at the time.
Well, that's certainly a very good question, and I think it's one of the reasons that a number of people suspected that there still had to be items hidden and possibly an effort being made to rebuild the Iraqi chemical weapons program simply because he was not cooperating. Hans Blix has suggested that Iraq may have had its own reasons for wanting to suggest to the world that it still had a chemical weapons capability, reasons of pride, reasons of deterrence. So it's a mystery, and until further explorations are done in Iraq and we have an opportunity to question the scientists and the technicians that were central to this program, perhaps once this process goes forward further, we'll get some greater clarity on exactly what took place.
Okay, Elisa Harris, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Elisa Harris is senior research scholar with the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland.
Another claim central to the case for war was that Iraq collaborates with terrorist groups, in particular with Al-Qaeda. Given a common hatred of the U.S., Iraq could develop deadly weapons and supply them to the likes of Osama bin Laden. President Bush put it this way last October in a speech in Cincinnati.
We know that Iraq and Al-Qaeda have had high-level contacts that go back a decade. Some Al-Qaeda leaders who fled Afghanistan went to Iraq. These include one very senior Al-Qaeda leader who received medical treatment in Baghdad this year and who has been associated with planning for chemical and biological attacks. We've learned that Iraq has trained Al-Qaeda members in bomb-making, and poisons, and deadly gases.
NPR's Tom Gelton joins us now. Tom, what of this claim, first generally?
Well, Robert, the interesting thing here is to distinguish between Iraq's support of terrorism in general and these very specific claims about Al-Qaeda. Of course, there have been, we know that Saddam Hussein encouraged suicide bombing attacks in Israel. There's a plentiful evidence that Saddam Hussein has supported terrorism. But when you get to the specific issue of Iraq's connections with al-Qaeda. It's not nearly so clear. President Bush mentioned these contacts going back a decade. The first point here to make is that according to intelligence officials, most of those contacts took place a decade or so ago, back in the time when Osama bin Laden was in Sudan in the early 1990s, before we really knew much about al-Qaeda. There's much less evidence of contacts in recent years. And then the second issue is what to make of those contacts. Officials with whom I've spoken say that Saddam's intelligence service had contacts with many nefarious groups, in part to keep track of them. Al-Qaeda is a radical Islamist group. Saddam had a secular regime. He may have felt threatened by them, and it would have been quite logical for him to want to sort of keep tabs on these groups, in part by having contacts with them.
What about the claim of about the senior Al-Qaeda leader who had received medical treatment? This was later elaborated. It was identified as one Zarqawi, Mr. Zarqawi, who had also had some supporters who were hanging around Baghdad, supposedly. What more do we know about this?
Abu Musab Zarqawi is a leader of a terrorist group that's said to be responsible for the murder of a U.S. diplomat in Jordan last October. But two questions. One is what relationship he had with the Saddam regime, and the second question is what relationship he actually had with al-Qaeda. President Bush called him a very senior al-Qaeda leader. The CIA and the State Department call him an associate, and I'm told that this is an important distinction because as an associate, he had informal relations with al-Qaeda, but actually operated somewhat independently of him.
Well, from what you've been able to glean from your reporting, was the statement that President Bush made back in October that we heard a bit of, is that a statement that U.S. intelligence findings actually support?
Robert, what I've been told is that of all the allegations you're discussing today, this is the most disputed, the least supported by intelligence. One interesting point, the CIA has an ombudsman to whom analysts can take complaints when they see someone politicizing their intelligence reporting. The one complaint the CIA ombudsman has gotten with respect to Iraq intelligence was not over weapons of mass destruction. It was over these claims that Saddam was supporting al-Qaeda.
Tom Gelton, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
In his joint press conference with British Prime Minister Tony Blair today, President Bush was emphatic. Saddam Hussein, he said, was a threat to security and peace. I strongly believe he was trying to reconstitute his nuclear weapons program, the president added. He was a threat, and I take responsibility for dealing with that threat.